So, good morning, everybody. Let's start in the text. The story of the lecture, or the storyline, is that we talk about modalities, image preprocessing, 3D reconstruction, and the chapter on 3D reconstruction was quite lengthy this time. And at some point, also during the lecture, I had the feeling that we got lost in too many details, that there is some danger that you lose the big picture of all of it. We will close the morning. We will close 3D reconstruction today. But before I do so, I will explain to you one filtering operation that was really pushed forward at the end of the 90s, 1998. And this filtering approach is used for many, many tasks, in particular also in the context of image smoothing. So we will talk about the bilateral filter. And I have slides for it, but let me sketch, as usual, the idea on the blackboard. Bilateral filter. That was basically introduced in 1998 by two computer vision researchers, Tomasi and Manducci. And they came up with a very, very interesting idea. I mean, if you want to build filter, and there is a whole theory on filter design and blah, 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 and you get lost with all these formalisms. If you build a filter, one of the simplest ideas is to take pixels in a neighborhood. To take pixels in a certain neighborhood in the image, and you just add up the intensity values in the neighborhood and compute the average. That's the mean filtering, yeah? The mean filter computes the average intensity value of a given neighborhood and assigns this pixel to the average value. By this, you can reduce the jumps of intensities, yeah? The random noise that you have, the variations in the local environment, and you flatten the image. The only consequence of a filter like this is if you have edges in the image, that means you have a bright area that goes into a dark area. Then at the edges, you start to smear, you start to sandpaper the edges, and you lose contrast information. So images that are processed by using mean filtering, they seem to be less noisy, yeah? Less noisier, but they appear a little bit blurred, unsharp, yeah? Blurred. And the question is, what do you want to do with the images, and what kind of information is available by the unfiltered image and the filtered image? And then, in many situations, it's also the personal taste that decides on whether you apply filtering or not. And the computation of the new intensity value is done by summing up here the x, y values in the neighborhood of the currently considered point nx. Let's call this g. That's the filtered image, f of x and y. And we can weight them uniformly, saying if I have a 3x3 neighborhood, each value is weighted by 1/9. Or you can also say, if the distance of two pixels is 1, I weight it with 1. If the pixel is square root of 2, I weight it with 1/2 or something like that. So you have here weights depending on the position, but not on the intensity values here. So these are weights. It's a very important thing what I wrote here. So we just look at the position of the intensity value and look how far away it is from the currently considered pixels, and we weight the intensity value of the current position just dependent on the geometry of our grid structure of the image. Okay? So I just say this intensity value goes into this averaging process by a prefactor that depends on the geometry. If I use mean filtering, I just have a binary condition saying it's 1 if it's in the 3x3 neighborhood and it's 0 otherwise. Yeah? So all are weighted by 1 if I just sum over the local neighborhood. If you use more sophisticated filters, you say this one is closer than this one. This one has distance square root of 2. This one has distance 1. So this should be having a higher impact on the solution than this one. And you can incorporate this by this weighting scheme. Okay, that's how very, very common image filters work. You look at the grid geometry and you weight the intensities and then you compute a linear combination if you do linear filtering of the neighboring pixels. So mean filtering means that Wx is 1/9 if you have the 3x3 neighborhood, or 0 dependent on the constraint that x and y is in the neighborhood of the currently considered pixel. So nxy otherwise. Okay. Now you can increase the window and say the farther away I am, the lower the weight will be. Anybody in the audience who didn't catch this idea?
What is the boundaries?
The boundaries we do not consider. The boundaries is always something that you have to consider separately. Usually you just set the boundary values to 0, then you get high frequencies in, or you just mirror the image in the directions and then you don't care about the boundaries. Hi. Or you shrink the image and use the valid values. Boundaries is a separate topic. It's something that we won't consider here. Okay? But a very important question. As usual in the lecture, right? I explain to you the simple things, and if you start to work on it, then it turns out that it doesn't work what I explained to you. Yeah? And then you show up in my office and tell me, well, I was so excited in the lecture, but I tried it and it doesn't work. And my response is,
Welcome to the club.
Yeah? If you try to implement these things, there are so many detailed problems that have to be addressed, yeah? That usually the algorithms I explain to you are not working. I mean, what kind of message is that, right? I explain in the lecture algorithms that do not work.
So how does one manage to keep motivated for computer vision and image processing and pattern recognition over 20 years when this is always what happens to you?
You know what is really the motivating part of it? It's the brilliant people you work with. Yeah, if you want to join us, you will come into a brilliant, inspiring environment where you meet nice, smart people doing cutting-edge research. That's what keeps you motivated. It's not that we talk all the time, but we really work. We do not discuss how things should work in principle and what's going to happen if it works. So we do it, we build it. And that's the fun part. Good. You got the idea? We all got the idea except Ingvar? Okay, good. And now, imagine, I did my PhD in 1996, and in 1998, this filter was published at a conference. And this filter is used all over the world now. It's used all over the world now. And if you look at it, it's so simple. And I'm so frustrated that I didn't come up with this idea, because it's so easy. At the end of the day, if you see it, you say, it's so easy. Huh? Why did it take so long to come up with this type of idea? So what did the two guys do? They said, okay, these are the standard filters. And then you know, you will find thousands of pages and books and papers and conferences on analyzing these filters and how to design the W, X, Y, and what properties you get if you choose a certain W, X, Y, and in which cases it works and in which cases it fails, and what happens at the borders and what different strategies you can use at the borders and blah, blah, blah. So you'll find thousands of papers and it's well understood. And these two guys said, in addition to the geometric neighborhood, we also look at the intensity neighborhood. And we do the following. We want to build a filter that is edge preserving. Edge preserving means if you have high differences in between the gray values or the intensity values, you just want to slow down your filtering operation in a sense that you do not filter too much. And if your difference is, you know, just on the noise level, you really jump in and say, here I filter like crazy to get rid of these differences in intensities. So what Carlo Tomasi and Manducci did is they looked at the local neighborhood. Yeah, like all the others did. And they also looked at the, no, I have to take this away. So they derive out of that weights of, if this here is X and Y, so weighting factors for this linear combinations derived from the geometry. And what Manducci and Tomasi did, is they looked at this, and then they have here f of x and y, respectively f of x prime, y prime, where x prime, y prime lives in the neighborhood of the currently considered point. And they say, I'm not only considering here the local geometric properties, but I have a second weighting factor, S, where I use the distance X prime, Y prime, FX, Y, where X prime, Y prime is in the neighborhood of X and Y. And I take prime, prime, and prime. That means he computes also a weight that depends on intensity values. So you don't use the position X and Y to compute a weight, but you take two intensity values in the neighborhood and their relationship. So you can, if you want to compute it for a certain point, you can compute, for instance, the distance of the, or the difference of the intensity values in the neighborhood, and derive a weight out of that. And you can say, if the distance is small, the S value should be high, and if the distance is high, the S value should be small. And they squeeze this all in into the sum of W X prime Y prime S of F X prime Y prime F X Y weighted by F X prime Y prime, for instance. So they build in another factor for the linear combination that considers the intensity values in the neighborhood. And that's why it's called bilateral filtering. You one on the one side. Pardon me? Question?
Yeah, I don't know where the intensities are. I can see them.
You can't see them? Here, these are the intensities, the function values. Yeah? So I have the position. That's the grid position in the image. And this here is the intensity value. Sorry for being not clear on that. So you weight by the globe, by the geometric neighborhood, and you weight by the intensity-based neighborhood. This filter has the disadvantage that it's not shift invariant. It always depends on the local structure of the image. If you just take the grid structure and you have a homogeneous grid, like we have in all the images we are considering, you can move things around and the W's, they will not change. Yeah, they will be the same for each locality. But the S's, they will change because they depend on the measurements. So the complexity of computing this filter or performing this filtering operation is higher, but the output will be way better. And that's the idea of the bilateral filter. So if I ask you in the oral exam, and I like the bilateral filter very much, something about the bilateral filter, this is the way you potentially can explain it. I mean, there are different ways. I'm pretty much convinced that our Chinese students will have a much smarter and simpler way to explain things due to the reasons our Brazilian student explained to me a few minutes ago. Yeah. I mean, that sounds a little bit like fun, but I really had the experience that, and that's independent from the nationality, even independent from the region in Germany you come from. Sometimes I have students, they explain to me things differently, and I take this explanation and carry it over to my lecture because it's a better, way better explanation than I have done so far. And I like that. Or I also had the situation that I was saying in the lecture, oh, the proof is so tricky, so technical, I omit it here. And then one student said in the oral exam, you said it's very tricky and technical, but I have a two-line proof. Yeah? And then he wrote it down, and I was so excited about that we wrote a paper on it. It's, sometimes it's nice. Well, it's always nice to have oral exams. Okay, so that's the idea. You bought it? Yeah? Okay, good. Now let's look at the slides. Oops. So edge-preserving filtering. Problem, how can we prevent averaging across edges? So the sandpapering operation over edges while maintaining the averaging properties in smooth regions, and bilateral filtering is the answer. That's a method for edge preserving noise reduction. And instead of simply averaging imaging values, independence of their geometric closeness, that's the W. I think in the slides we call it C, closeness. We also take the photometric similarity, that means the measured intensity values and the differences of intensity values of the pixels nearby to compute the new pixel. That's the idea. Yeah? And the funny thing is that one of the inventors, Carlo Tomasi, yes?
Heuristic, isn't it? So we practically have no guarantee to every image.
Okay. According to her theory, he has the answer.
I think the bilateral filtering is a combination of two Gaussian filters. Once you can combine two Gaussian filters, I think it will work from Fourier theory or not.
Where do you know this from, that this is a combination of two Gaussian filters in practice? Because?
I already took in
class. Ah! Okay. You should say you invented it in 1997, but didn't publish, or you published it only in Chinese, or was limited to a very small community. No. Okay, that's right. That's a good answer. You usually use Gaussian functions, and we will see it in a few minutes, to model W, and a Gaussian function to use to model S. And then you can take all the theory and propagate it through all these formulas and come up with similar results for non-stationary filters. But the answer, that's the smart answer. The poor man's answer I would give to you is, I mean, the results are so brilliant for many, many problems we have out there that I don't need a theoretical justification for it at the end of the day. Yeah. And then just for your story, I was a postdoc in Carlo Tommasi's team exactly these days when he published it. And he went to India to present the result. And I was so excited about it. And then I came back from Stanford, and I worked for industry, and I saw all the filters that we had in our X-ray systems, and I said, well, let's use the bilateral filter. Yeah, and then we built in the bilateral filter into all the X-ray imaging systems we had at the company I was working for, a mid-range small company. And nowadays, the bilateral filter is everywhere in medical image processing. And when we started to sell the first product, I called Carlo and said, come on, tell me which patent you filed for it. Yeah, and unfortunately, what do you think what happened? Mm-hmm. He didn't file it. He didn't file it. So he has no house on Hawaii. He didn't file it. And what is the message of the story? Even the simplest idea should be considered for patents. Okay? Even the simplest ideas. Or the other way around, the simple ideas usually work pretty well, and you always should be very serious about it. If you come up with simple ideas, you should seriously considering filing a patent. Yeah? Interesting, huh? He did not file a patent on this. It's really a pity, and if you browse the web, in particular, if you browse our publications in the lab, we have so many cool applications of bilateral filters. I'll give you one. There was a paper published in 2005-06. Again, a paper, it took me three lines to read, and I was sitting there and saying, no, why didn't I come up with a smart idea? I'll tell you. If you have, who is a photographer in the audience? Nobody? Mobile phone photographer or selfie, smile here, smile there?
As a hobby.
Okay. What happens if you photograph with flash?
Well, if it's the flash from the camera, the picture usually sucks because it's so illuminated in the front and then the back is all.
Okay. Yeah. It's recorded. No, don't worry. So. If you use words like this, that flattens also my things, or those things I say. Okay, you say if you have flash, they change things. For instance, the contrast changes. Yeah, and that means if you do a post-processing of these images, usually they don't look like the way you want to have it. And if you don't use a flash, but you have a rather mean illumination condition, what happens then?
Well, I usually either increase the ISO or the speed, so I get
Okay. So you should talk to a mobile phone photographer. So if you take a picture, you get a lot of noise, but the colors look usually way better. Yeah, but the image isn't that much suited for post-processing. So you have advantages with a flash image and advantages with a non-flash image. And these guys, they
They're not combining it.
They are combining it.
Oh, no.
They sit there, do a flash image, a non-flash image, and then they take this formula, and they call it guided filtering, and they guide the filtering of one image by using, of course, geometric neighborhoods in the one image, and this one they take out of the other image, the differences of the intensities. Yeah? And that's extremely cool. Yeah? You take two images and you say, I use the image of one, use the information of one image to drive the filtering process in the other image that has lower image quality. And we use, we use that like hell in many of our algorithms nowadays, where we compute reconstructions from different subsets. We compute the average volume. We use the average volume to drive the filtering of a separate volume. And we get brilliant enhancements of images by using this type of idea, guided filtering. Take two images of the same situation, and you can say they do not differ in the anatomy, but in the noise, they differ. And they differ maybe also in the intensity values. And you can combine these things by using this type of idea. Guided filtering. It's so cool. It takes you 2 seconds to understand what they did, and it takes you 5 years to come over it that you didn't come up with this idea. Huh? That's, well, maybe it takes you 4 years, but good. Guided filtering. And I'm sure there are hundreds and millions of this type of ideas out there that are not yet developed. So take this message also back home for you to allow yourself to be a fresh thinker, to grow into this type of arrogance, saying, I can't read this book with 5,000 pages on system theory and filtering theory. Forget about it. I mean, if you need something, you can look it up. Be a fresh thinker. Yeah? Try to look at the problem and try to come up with a different idea. Do not follow the track of others. That's what I can recommend. And that's also why people like pretty much the cool papers that we write for many problems, because we always try things nobody had thought of. And usually we come from different disciplines and think across disciplines. So here is the situation that you have the weighting. I called it W on the blackboard. I apologize for this. This is the closeness weight. And here you have the function values. Linear filters can be expressed in terms of convolutions. So what we do is we have here the difference from the mean position that we are currently considering. And here's the weighting. And this is just a scaling factor. That is 1/9 for the 3x3 neighborhood, or whatever if you use a different neighborhood. Yeah. And here you see what starts again. The formulas begin to look very complicated, and you really lose to see the core idea of it. So keep the blackboard in mind and try to get an intuition for the formulas. There is nothing more in it. It's just more general characterization of the idea I explained to you. Yeah. So f of xy denotes the observed image. Xy is the position. F is the intensity value. C of x, y, mi and ni measures the geometric closeness between the neighborhood center, xy, and the point mi ni. I call it x prime and y prime on the blackboard. No? So if you have here these two points, the c value of this position and this position, that just tells you the weighting in the sum here. Yeah? Is it 1/9, or is it 1/2, or is it 5? Okay. Somehow I don't have a nice way to turn it on. The normalization factor is just the integral over the distances that this is supposed to be a normalization factor that you end up with values in the range that you had before filtering the image. Yeah? That looks difficult, it's nothing spectacular. So, and now low-pass range filters. It again looks a little bit complicated here in the formula, but the core is already written on the blackboard. You say, you look at the intensity value at the position, and then you have a value that just depends on two intensity values in the neighborhood. Yeah, that's this term here. If you have the situation that one intensity value is here and the other is here, and let's say this intensity value is 5 and this is 6, the S value will be the same, like one intensity value here and one here. If this point falls into the neighborhood and this is 5 and this is 6, the S value will be the same, independent of the distance. Yeah, it just has to sit in the neighborhood. And the weight is dependent on the intensity values, but not on the distance from the currently considered point. Okay, that's what it's saying here. That's a low-pass range filter, low-pass intensity filter. We don't look at the geometric neighborhoods, but at the neighborhoods of the measurements. Okay, and this one was also known long time ago. It was published, and Tomasi Manduki said, why don't I compute the product of these two values, C, the closeness, and S, the similarity of the intensity values, and squeeze it into one formula. And that's exactly what they did. Yeah? So they combine the intensity values, the geometric closeness, and the similarity, that dot is nonsense here, and the similarity of the intensities. And here, again, this is just a normalization factor to make sure that the final result sits in the same range of intensity values. How do we deal with constants, usually in Europe? Yeah, hand waving. We fix that afterwards, usually. How do you deal with it?
The same way.
The same way, OK. You are adapting. OK. I'll show you an example, and that's what Yijin was mentioning. Gaussians. Now we think about how can I choose Z, the closeness function, and S, the similarity function. And the first choice usually for us is to use Gaussians. Yeah? If we don't know what to use, we use Gaussians. That's usually our first shot in image processing, pattern recognition, computer vision. If we have to do something with probabilities, PDFs, we use Gaussians. So we use this one here. We take the L2 norm. That means the Euclidean distance of the two position vectors divided by the variance. Yeah. The scaling factor here is omitted. Yeah. It's a constant if you integrate over all x, y values, but it's not one. You need a constant over there, but we ignore it. How do we choose the similarity function? Same idea. We just take the difference of the intensity values. Yeah, if the difference of the intensities is small, the Gaussian function gives us a high value. If the distance is large, it gives us a low value. So exactly what we want to achieve by our filtering. The previous formula, if you have a pixel that is close to the currently considered one, we want to have a high weight. So if the difference is small, Gaussian will respond with a high value. If the intensities are similar, we want to have a high value. That's done by the Gaussian. If the intensities are very much similar, if the intensities are very much different, we want to make sure that the filtering operation is slowed down, yeah, or decreased, or decelerated, or whatever term you want to use from physics. And this is also provided by the Gaussian. If the difference is high, the Gaussian value will be very small. Now you can plot the two functions. You can plot the two functions. Here, do I have, let's see, no. We have here an example. That's stolen from the paper of Tomasi Manducci. That's an image with a typical edge here. So we have intensity value, let's say 10, and noise. Yeah? That's the surface of the image you see. Or let me say one sentence how this plot is generated. If you look at an image, you see intensities and intensity variations. You keep in mind this is a grid, and each grid point carries an intensity value. What you can do now is you can rotate the image a little bit and look at it in 3D, and the intensity values can be visualized in a 3D plot. The intensity values, the higher they are, the higher the function values will be. So you can look at an image in terms of an intensity matrix, or you can look at an image in terms of a 2D function where you have the profile, the 3D surface profile of the intensity values. And that's what we did here. So we have, in principle, we have an image that looks like this. We have a small value, then we have here the edge, and then we have here a high value. And I look at this in terms of the surface function. I look how the function values, are distributed over the xy plane. So this here is the x direction, the y direction, and here the height values are the function values. So we see there are two regions. There is noise. They are jumping up and down. But here at the edge, you have a significant change of the intensities. And now you can compute for each point here in the image the product of the closeness and the similarity function, CS. And if you look at the filter that is applied, for instance, here, you see that you get for the product function a Gaussian that is cut off at the edge here. So that is the filtering mask that you basically apply to this function. This mask is changing depending on the position where you are in the image. And you see that you do not filter across the borders or the edge. And that means you have here a flattening of these homogeneous regions, and you maintain the intensity jump at the edge. And the results you get are very, very nice. In particular, if you deal with PET and SPECT images where you have very noisy measurements, this filter really generates very nice results.
This would be the mask for the right part or for the left part?
This one is the measured image, and this is the filtered image, and this is the filtered kernel.
The kernel, it depends on the point where you're looking at.
Yeah. For instance, you can sit here. Yeah, you say you don't consider these values, you just consider these values for filtering. Yeah, so if you apply the mask to this point, you don't consider these points here, and you have some higher values here that depends on very similar intensity values maybe. And here, you know, you are on this side, the weighting, the geometric based weighting tells you take as much as possible from this side because they are locally very similar, and the intensity values do not differ so much. So you get here more the Gaussian shape, and on this side, this filter tells you don't touch these points for your filtering operations. Okay? Because this will pull down your intensity value and smear your edge if you take these values down there into your computation. Intuitively clear? Good. So here we have examples where we implemented this. What do you see here? What modality What type of anatomy? What? Here the abdomen, right? You see the abdomen. What type of modality is it? It's a CT. It's a CT reconstruction. And on the left-hand side, you see the reconstruction result, and you see here, what organ is it? That's the liver. What is this? What is this? And this? That's the fillet. That's the fillet. Yeah, that's this muscle back there. Okay. You see here, this patient has a tumor, or these are the vessels. I'm not a radiologist, but there is something that looks inhomogeneous. You see here in these homogeneous regions the noise, and this is the bilateral filtered result. That's the bilateral filtered result, and would you say it looks better and less noisier? Yeah. Huh? And if you do that in between the acquisition, when the patient sits on the table or in the system, you acquire the data and you show the doctor right away the right image, then he will say, wow, that's a cool scanner, very nice image quality. If you don't perform the filtering, the bilateral filtering, you get this type of result. And now you can imagine, we are talking about investments of 1 million, 2 million euros, and if the doctors go to a showroom and they look at the images, they decide on the image quality at the end of the day, which system they built. And the conclusion is, four lines of code can decide on a 2 million investment. Huh? And at this point, when they look at the images, they don't care about the marketing brochure. They care about the images they see. And that explains the role of computer scientists, medical engineers, software engineers in such a company. Yeah? That explains the high value that you have for a company, if you can do things like that. If the brochure changes the color and it takes a team of 10 people to decide on the color, that's nice. Yeah? I mean, that's the social part of such a company. But if, you don't get my jokes here, but if it's, if we are talking about real world and real value generation within a company, we talk about things like that. Huh? And you know, the interesting thing is my job was to say to my team members, let's use bilateral filtering. That was my contribution. And then I had students and they built it. And at the end of the day, I said, well, that was my idea. Hard work for 5 weeks. Yeah, cool. That's how it works. And everybody was happy. We can also use it for fixing problems and artifacts that we get in by using reconstruction algorithms. For instance, if we don't have a coverage of 180 degrees for reconstruction, or if we have the situation that we do not properly weight our projection rays, we have to fight with artifacts. And the question is, how can we eliminate these artifacts afterwards by post-processing operations? And it turns out that bilateral filtering is doing a great job in this situation, and we have found many, many applications where we applied the idea of bilateral filtering for reconstruction. Also, the idea of using this weighting scheme within the reconstruction algorithm led to improvements of the reconstructions that are also visible. For instance, here we have a darker area that is due to reconstruction artifacts and not well compensated by Parker weights. And if you use a compensation method that takes this type of idea of bilateral filtering within the reconstruction, it turns out that you can reduce the number of artifacts. So there are many, many samples out there where we did bilateral filtering and incorporate the bilateral filtering for guided filtering, for combining projection images with reconstruction results, and so on. The take-home messages of today, simple ideas are mostly the best ones. Yeah, please keep that in mind. The more the more complicated the algorithm is, people explain to me, the worse I feel about the impact. The design and implementation of it is still a major part of research in image processing. What does that mean? If you implement this algorithm the way I explained it to you, it will be so slow. It will be slow because you have these local masks that have to be computed, and the community did a lot of work in reducing the complexity, in reducing the complexity of this filtering operation. And the ways we did is, on the one side, there was a lot of work done to map these algorithms on GPUs. Nowadays, it takes nothing to compute the bilateral filtered image. GPU implementations exist. We, in our lab, did many GPU implementation and many experiments on that. And in industry nowadays, bilateral filtering is also done on GPUs in the imaging systems that are provided by the big vendors. I know there is a colleague at MIT. His major research focus is bilateral filtering. Yeah, so he stands up in the morning and starts to think about bilateral filtering and falls asleep while he is thinking about bilateral filtering. He's doing a lot of work in this field. And the community also now tries to understand how is the bilateral filter linked to other filters that are known. And there are proofs that the bilateral filter is a special case of some filter that is known for 500 years. Yes, okay, that's good, but it doesn't help so much. Yeah? But for the deep understanding, that's fine. Bilateral filtering is computational, very expensive, requires acceleration. I commented on this. Bilateral filtering is used in medical products a lot. It would be very, really interesting to see how much it would be used if I wouldn't have been with Carlo Tomasi that time and moved to Siemens afterwards. It's interesting how much impact a single person could also have without having good ideas, just, you know, transferring things from one side to the other side. You can change the world as well. Bilateral filtering can be applied to any image, independent from the modality. The characteristics of edge-preserving smoothing is important. And the edge-preserving smoothing can compensate for many advantages of expensive reconstruction algorithms. That's something that I just told you intuitively without going into details. So what do we remember? We use geometry as well as photometric information for driving the filtering process. Okay? And if you join us for interventional medical image processing, we will explain to you other filters, guided filtering, for instance, that is a good approximation of the bilateral filtering and is way more efficient than bilateral filtering and is doing a pretty good job as well. Right? You remember? Good. And now let's come to the end of the lecture. We will now talk about one topic I also find very exciting, like everything I do, image registration. And if you would have asked me 10 years ago what I think about image registration, I would say this is image frustration. The reason for that was image registration is very much required by doctors. I mean, think about the situation. You have different modalities. Yeah? You have a patient like me. I'm in the age where the frequency of visiting doctors is increasing. You get a CT, you get an MR, you get an ultrasound. So if you have a problem that is to be diagnosed and very difficult to be classified, you get multiple modalities applied to your body and you generate different images, and each modality has its own advantage. Yeah? And what do doctors do? And you know that from Dr. House, yeah? Yeah? You have your light box, and then Dr. House does this. He puts a film here, a film sheet here, a film sheet here. He steps back, looks at it, and then he mentally combines the images of the different modalities and builds up a joint image. He does image fusion. I'm not sure whether Dr. House is doing image fusion mentally, but at least you can imagine in this setup that things like that could potentially happen. Did you notice that Dr. House is using Siemens systems? These are the things I look at, you know? What type of imaging workstations do they use? Very interesting. Huh? Comment? You don't watch things like that.
Huh? Is anyone still not using Siemens stuff?
Yes, of course. I can't comment on things like that because it's recorded. And I'm more under control than I have been in the past. Good. Knowing that people might look in more detail into things what I say. But you're right. Good. Okay, so we need to talk about image registration. We want to compute what Dr. House does mentally. We want to compute by using the image information. We want to compute a transformation into a joint coordinate system where all the images live in. Yeah? And then you can switch back and forth without moving things around, switch back and forth between the different modalities, select a point in space and say, I want to see his liver at this point where the beer comes in. Yeah? And then you can see what happens in ultrasound, you can see what happens in MR and what happens in CT. Okay? And the question is, how can you compute this, this deformation of the images to make sure that the images are registered, and registered means they sit in the same coordinate system where the points in space are assigned to each other properly. And why it is called image frustration, 10 years ago, I will also tell you in a few seconds. So image registration, if you hear that, image registration is the process of transforming different images of different modalities or of the same modality at different time points into one common or one joint coordinate system. The registration of volumes is also subsumed by the term of image registration. Whether I use 2D images or I move 3D volumes around and bring them together, that doesn't matter. Image registration is exactly this process of computing the transformation of the different images into a joint coordinate system. Okay? That's the abstract definition. And we distinguish between rigid and non-rigid registration. Rigid registration means, for instance, here you see a line, and this is a modality that has generated, for instance, an edge. And another modality, your iPhone camera or your smartphone camera captures here this geometric setup, and I can tell you this edge you see here is exactly this edge here. And registration means I move just the one edge that I have found with my edge camera, and I move it to my color image at the point where the edge actually sits in space. And I call this rigid transformation or rigid registration if I take it and I have just 6 degrees of freedom. That's the movement into the x direction, the y direction, the z direction, and then I have the rotation, this direction, and this direction. Yeah? So I have 6 degrees of freedom, the extrinsic parameters we have seen in the context of camera calibration. Rigid means you just compute 6 parameters. How do I have to move and orient one object to be aligned with the other one? Okay? And now I say this is the edge that is detected by our camera, and this is the edge that our color image shows, yeah? And I want to register the two. What do I have to do? I have to bend it, okay? I have to deform one image to make it fit. I guess you will remember this. Yeah? Yeah? So Arnold Schwarzenegger, you have a straight, Joachim Hornegger, you have a bended. Yeah? The double G example, okay? I had at Stanford, I was teaching, and I had one sample homework problem where I had images where Arnold Schwarzenegger was in the image and Joachim Honegger was in the image. And the title of the exercise sheet was, "Where is Honegger, where is Schwarzenegger?" Because that's my running joke in the US. When they ask, "How do you write your name?" I say, "Honegger like Schwarzenegger." Then they know how to write it. And I met one student 15 years later. And he exactly remembered this exercise problem and me. It's cool, right? He's now also a professor. And he was saying, "I remember you. You were teaching the computer vision class. And I remember the problem. Where is Honegger? Where is Schwarzenegger?" Cool. So maybe you will remember that as well. So we have rigid registration, Schwarzenegger. We have non-rigid. I will make a donation to the Department of Electrical Engineering. Can you cut it out? And we have the Honegger deformation, okay? Rigid and non-rigid registration. And what do you think, what is simpler? The rigid appears to be simpler, but in practice, it's as hard as non-rigid to make it really work. Huh? That's our experience. Good. Okay. Now the question is, how can you compute the transformation based on the images? And the interesting thing is that if you look from a certain distance to the problem, you say, if I have points that I find in two scenarios, then I can use the point correspondence to compute the transformation. Yeah, and that's what is done in medicine quite a lot. So people put markers into the patient that are fixed to the patient. For instance, if you talk to a neurosurgeon or a neuroradiologist, they don't have a problem to run a marker into the skull. Yeah? If you say, "I need a marker, I need five markers," no problem. Take the drill, boop, boop, and put the markers in. Yeah, and the patients carry these markers, and whenever they sit in an imaging modality, you have these points, remarkable points, and you can find them easily, and then you compute the correspondence and do the general math to compute the transformation. What do you think? How many point correspondences do we need to compute the 3D rotation and translation? Three. We need three points. If you just have one point, you know you have to move this point to that point, but you can rotate arbitrarily. Yeah? So you, with one point, you can compute 3 degrees of freedom if you have one point. If you have two points in the two images, you can assign the two points. You can move the object there, but you can still rotate around the around the axis that links the two points without changing the assignment. So you need a third point to make sure that no rotation around this is possible. So yeah, you have these are the three points. These are the three points. If I just assign the thumb, I can rotate around this point. I have just one hook. If I have two assigned points, I still can rotate around the axis where the point assignment doesn't change in the position, but the object still has a degree of freedom. And if you have a third point, nothing can happen anymore. Okay, so you need at least, you have to drill at least three points into the skull. For patients, tumor patients, for instance, where the tumor sits very deep in the brain, that you cannot do surgery because you would kill the patient if you cut through the brain to the depth of the tumor. The patients usually get radiation treatment. So you use high energy radiation from different directions, and at those points where the radiation beams intersect, the energy is added up, and you try to generate energies by using rays from different directions that really intersect at the point where the tumor is, and then they start to cook the tumor and to kill the tumor cells. That's the way how patients are treated. And that requires, of course, a very, very good understanding of the geometry, because you don't want to cook a healthy brain tissue. You just want to make sure that you have the tumor and maybe the rim around the tumor to make sure that you get them all. And for these patients, they are very, very sick. The companies that built the radiation systems they require to really mount a rack at the head of the patient. And those patients, they walk around with a rack. Yeah, I was once in a hospital for two weeks where these things have been done. And if you see those patients, you know, getting set up the markers and the rack to their head to get the radiation therapy. And just for registration purposes, you need this type of setup. And of course, our intention has to be to come up with algorithms that do this without markers by just looking at the intensity values that we measure, because the intrinsic information is in there. Yeah, we just need algorithms to get this type of information with a reliability that is good for the patients. Also here, if you do surgery nowadays, the instruments for surgery, they carry markers. And the surgery scene is observed by stereo cameras, stereo infrared cameras. And what they do is they look where the points are in space, and then they do a registration, and they know where the knife is of the surgeon and how the knife is related to the CT, preoperative CT data set. And you can use augmented reality during the operation to guide things. You can, for instance, project the vessel system of the liver onto the surface of the liver if you have such a registered scenario, that the surgeon knows how to cut and how to make sure that he doesn't hit the vessels that sit within the liver that are not visible, but with augmented reality, he gets a good understanding where the big ones are. So a lot of support that we can actually provide here for the doctors. And the first problem we are considering is, let's compute the transformation for 2D images on 2D images using point correspondences. I really broke the pointer. That's bad. I mean, the problem is you don't pay tuition anymore, so I really have to find the financing for that. I have to pay it on my own. I will go to OBI and go get a new one for Monday. Even dangerous, yeah. Can hurt yourself. I'm looking forward to your comments. Who?
You?
Oh, okay. We just have just one feedback, so thank you very much. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Yeah. You have to learn to deal with my kind of humor. It's totally anonymous. We just record the IP addresses and have a clear assignment. I mean, what you have to learn in life is never trust a computer scientist. He knows way more about you than you might imagine. And, you know, I live in a small village close to Erlangen, and my neighbors really don't know what I'm doing. Yeah, they know I'm a professor. They can't believe that, because I run around with shorts and this is a professor. Destroys my image of a professor. Once the lady across the street asked me what I'm actually doing, and I'm saying, yeah, we are analyzing the computers and we build algorithms. So for instance, I see which web pages you look and what you do and what type of emails you write. These are things we can follow. Yeah? Since that day, she's no longer saying hi to me. I don't have time to do things like that, but it's nice to tell people, you know, to give them a feeling what we are doing. Good. But that's not what I want to tell you. And it's not recorded. Thank you. So the problem is 2D registration using point features. So we do exactly what I have shown to you. We have drilled in some markers, and we just have two dimensional images, and we have a rigid transformation. So the problem is we have points here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and we can somehow compute the point correspondences. And what we have to compute is the rotation and translation of these two point sets. Huh? So I put points on a piece of paper, and then I rotate and translate them, and I want you to compute the rotation and translation out of the point correspondences. How many degrees of freedom do we have? The number of unknowns? Well, we have the translation in the plane. These are two unknowns. And then we have the in-plane rotation. That's another degree of freedom. That's in the range of 0 and 2 pi. That's the in-plane rotation. OK? And now, given. So we have three unknowns. We have three unknowns. And now we have given Pi, Qi, element of R2. So we have corresponding points. The points here I call Pi, and the points here I call Qi. Okay? And I know that I have to rotate and translate Pi to get Qi. So I know that Qi is the rotation of P. That's the rotation. And how the rotation matrix looks like if we use the rotation angle phi, that's something we did already. That's a sine cosine matrix. Yeah? Remember, the base vectors form the columns of the matrix. That's something we know by heart. He knows by heart, for sure. You knew it before I explained it to you, right? Of course. I'm proving your theory empirically. Plus t. Well, that's something you usually learn in the first year in linear algebra. OK. And basically, I can tell you the problem is now solved for a computer scientist, right? Because we have equations for I is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. If we have 5 point correspondences, if we have 500 point correspondences, we get 500 equations. And the question is, how do we compute phi and t? Now, out of that. Yeah? How do we compute the rotation matrix and the translation vector? Now, I can say, again, it's always the same. That's the fun part. Yeah? It's always the same in our community. We are repeating ourselves. So I say Pi rotated and translated is my Qi. Now, I can say, OK, but I have signals, and signals are noisy. And so this equation will never, ever be true for all the points. It will be roughly true. Roughly true means I compute Pi R plus T. And roughly true. And I subtract this from Qi, and I say this is roughly the zero vector. If this is roughly the zero vector, the norm here is roughly zero. And if the matching is proper and I have the right rotation and translation, I can sum up over all the points and say this has to be minimized for t and phi. So I take the point correspondences, I set up this objective function, that depends on phi and t1 and t2, the translation in x and y direction. I know how phi goes into the rotation matrix by these cosine sine terms. I can write this in MATLAB right away and optimize this function, and or let's say minimize this function for phi, t1, and t2. Okay? That's the least square estimator. So we minimize the squared error between the points in one image and the points in the other image transformed by the parametric mapping. Okay, so it's a three-dimensional optimization problem we have to solve. Yijin, are you happy?
Yes.
Okay. So maybe I missed something. Why are you happy?
Because of every time we can use this square estimation to do the optimization.
Okay. Stefan, are you happy?
Yes.
Yes. Who is not happy? My students are all happy. I can tell you, I'm unhappy. I'm unhappy because this is not a linear optimization. This is not a quadratic function, so it will not end up with a system of linear equations. Why? Because the unknown phi sits in cosine and sine functions and is somehow combined within the norm. And so I have a nonlinear optimization problem. And that makes me unhappy. I know that you are way more advanced in terms of optimization theory than I am, and you might deal with this type of optimization problem in a very smart way that I'm not aware of. But I personally, you know, my vision is always write something down, reduce it to an SVD computation, and let others do the job. Yeah? That's what I intend to do. And if I have a quadratic function, I know it's convex, and I know the minimum I compute that's unique, that's the only one we have, and I don't have to have the feeling that I got stuck in some site minimum, you know, and I treat the patient at a point where he shouldn't be treated. Yeah? But I have a convex function, I know that I push and burn the ray into the point that is the unique solution for my type of problem. So, of course, you can implement this and do a nonlinear optimization, gradient descent based on some initial value and compute a solution for it. But in general, we are very unhappy. I am very unhappy because this is a nonlinear nonlinear optimization problem. It's not a disaster. This is a not very hard nonlinear optimization problem. You can get it way worse, but it's a nonlinear optimization problem. And now there are two strategies to deal with this type of optimization problem. And one strategy is to say, first approach. One idea is to say we look at the rotation matrix. The rotation matrix R is cosine phi sine phi minus sine phi cosine phi. Where does he know it from? He knows it. Okay? You don't need to know it. You just need to know how to compute that, how to get this. Then you can say, there are just two unknowns, right? Two unknowns in. So I call R1 to be cosine of phi and R2 to be sine of phi. And I replace phi by R1 and R2. And I also have the constraint that R1 square plus R2 square is 1. That's the constraint. And I set up the surrogate optimization problem. So minimize sum over I qi R1 R2 R2 minus R1 pi plus t subject to R1 square plus R2 square is 1. And this is a convex optimization problem. So a unique solution, and it can be solved, boom, like this, by using convex optimization techniques. If you are not familiar with that, we can use the second type of approach that I'm going to write here. You can incorporate this in terms of a Lagrangian multiplier, compute the derivative, and you will get a very nice linear solution to it. Yeah? You feel happy with this type of explanation, or you need more information on it? You feel happy? No? Roughly. Okay. I show you a way nicer way of doing that, and the medical engineering students, they know it from the basic lecture, because that was an example I've shown to them in the first semester to motivate the math class a little bit. And 10 minutes are totally sufficient to tell you that things are important where you might have thought of that they are not important. So second approach. I have a point in the xy plane. Yeah? Points in the xy plane. We also know points are given by their coordinates, let's say A and B. And in the first year of your university career, you have seen complex numbers. It's the same. I have here real part, imaginary part, and here I have a complex number, and here I have my imaginary, my real part and my imaginary part. So if I have a vector x, I still have too much energy. AB, and here I have my complex number x a plus I times b. So I have a one-to-one correspondence of points in the 2D plane and complex numbers. Yeah? I give you two coordinates, you can write the you can draw the point. I give you a complex number, you look at the real part and the imaginary part, and you can draw the point. And you trust me that you can have here a one-to-one relationship. Yeah? Okay. That means it doesn't matter whether I give you the points pi and qi in terms of two-dimensional coordinates or in terms of complex numbers. Okay? Now Yishin might say, so what? Yeah, well, so what? Complex numbers have nice properties. And maybe we can use with this different type of interpretation of 2D points the theory of complex numbers to solve our problems in a way simpler way that we have done it so far. And that's the way we are going to do that. If I have a complex number, or a two-dimensional point, I can rewrite the point in terms of polar coordinates. That's the length. That's the length. The length, that's the square root of a square plus b square. And that's the angle. So I can represent each point in the plane by an angle and the Euclidean distance to the origin. The same I can do with complex numbers. This here is the absolute value of the complex number. That is actually real part square plus imaginary part square, and square root of it. And this here is the angle phi, and I can write all complex numbers in terms of the norm, let me write it this way, the absolute value, the length, times e to the power of I phi. That's the Euler representation of a complex number, okay? And the nice thing is, if I have now to compute the product of two complex numbers, I can rewrite the product in terms of x1 absolute value times I phi 1, that's the phi for the first point, times x2 e I phi 2. And this is x1, x2 times phi 1 plus phi 2. That's the product of two complex numbers using the Euler notation. You know that, right? Can we interpret these, this geometrically? Yes, we can. This is, if I compute the product of two complex numbers, that's nothing else than a rotation and a scaling. So all rotations and scalings in the 2D image plane can be expressed in terms of a product of complex numbers. How cool is that? Multiplication of complex numbers represent rotations and scalings in 2D. Scaled rotations in 2D can be expressed in terms of products of complex numbers. And product Drehstreckung, yeah, corresponds to rotation and scaling. And if I use a unit complex number that has length 1, I have a rotation. So the problem now in terms of complex numbers is find the complex number that I have to multiply all the other points with in our registration scenario. We consider this now in the real and imaginary plane. And that means we multiply all these points considered as complex numbers by a single complex number that is a unit complex number that has the norm 1, such that we end up with these complex points. Yeah, that's the problem we have to solve. Find a complex unit number, complex number that you multiply these points with to end up with these points that are considered in terms of the language of complex numbers. And if we do that, we end up with a system of linear equations. We don't need rotation matrices and things like that. We just use the language of complex numbers. So the problem now is, we consider the point Pi and Qi all in C as complex numbers. We say we have our rotation R, that's also a complex number, and our translation, well, if I have to translate a point in the 2D image plane, that means we have to add a complex number to it. And also the translation T is also a complex number. And the optimization problem that we need to solve is we have R times Qi plus T minus Pi, the absolute value of it. We end up with a complex number. We take the length of the number, and we sum up over all the I. And we minimize this. And now we can say either we allow scaling, then R can be any complex number, or we want to have just rotation, then we can say subject to R is a unit complex number. Yes?
Is there a reason that P and Q switched? Or?
No, there is no reason. Did I switch it? Sorry for that. Well, there is a reason that it was switched. That just tells you that I'm not well prepared and that I didn't think through it in detail before. I should have my note where I can copy everything and not do everything by heart here. But on the other way, if you don't know, if you have to copy it from a piece of paper, it's questionable whether it's important, yeah? Because if the professor has to copy it from a piece of paper, that just tells you maybe it's not so important. Okay, you got the transfer? And I mean, if I multiply complex number in this, here we have seen that's just the geometric interpretation we bring in. In the above equation, we use this representation and just use, you know, real part plus I times imaginary part, and then we do the multiplication component wise. And then we minimize this by just saying we compute the derivative with respect to the unknowns, and we will end up with a system of linear equations. And we are done. The linear equations we will write on Monday in more detail. Thank you very much. Enjoy the weekend and have a nice and workful day.